Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This started a long life of group homes, detention centers, and ultimately prison.
At what point did they intervene? Why didn't they intervene?
It's a situation that I would not want to find myself in. I would never want to get attacked, and I would never want to have to defend myself by killing somebody.
And the big question we always ask, John, is justice been served here?
This is True Crime Cast.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John. How's it going?
Hey, man, it's going great. We are rocking and rolling over here on True Crime Cast and True Crime To Go.
Yeah, trying to get ahead for the holidays. We, the last couple of years, have found ourselves scrambling to get everything done. So we're, for once, being proactive. It certainly helps that you live next door.
Yeah, it's nice in a lot of different reasons. Especially convenient to drive to football games together. So
yeah, we would never do that though.
Yeah, that's old news by the time this comes out, but Tennessee did beat Kentucky over the weekend that we're recording. So things have been a little tense, but we're plugging right along.
We're getting over it. John's wearing blue today, which I'm very thankful for. Also thankful that we have another member of our Patreon family.
Yeah, and this one is Michelle, who came in at $10 a month. So she will get access immediately to all of our content over on Patreon, an autographed picture of the two of us, and a special shout out. I'm going to let Jamie handle that.
Yeah, Michelle, your support is so much appreciated and needed here. We say it time and again, we would not be here if it wasn't for the support that we get over on Patreon, and people like Michelle make that happen. And we've also been putting out, because we are ahead, our Patreon members are getting early episodes that are ad-free coming out each week. So a day early for True Crime Cast content.
And with zero ads. So take advantage of that if you're a Patreon member. And yeah, like Jamie said, you guys keep the lights on over here at True Crime Cast, and we really appreciate you.
So John, I try to weave in sports to our stories as much as I can. You and I talk about football and basketball in here, but just generally I like athletics. I like the athletic world. And just like every other area of life, sports is not immune to criminal activity, and unfortunately not immune to violence. So with that, why don't you get us rolling?
Yeah, we're going to go back to January of 1981. That's when law enforcement in the Pacific Northwest were faced with a string of violent assaults and robberies. Now, because the perpetrator seemed to prefer committing his crimes along the I-5 corridor, he was soon given the name the I-5 Bandit. Now, it wouldn't be long before he'd become known as the I-5 Killer, which suggests that there's kind of an escalation happening, right? Every incident had a very similar description. It was an athletic man with a revolver and tape on his nose, abducted a woman, committed the sexual act, and then shot her execution style. What a horrible MO that we're going to be talking about today. Now, the police weren't without suspects. Near the top of their lists was a man that they knew very well, Randy Woodfield.
Now, Randy was born on December 26th of 1950 in Salem, Oregon. He was the third child in a middle-class home. His mom was a homemaker, and his dad was an executive with Pacific Northwest Bell. So they were doing pretty well. He had two older sisters. One became a doctor. One became an attorney. No pressure there. They just went into two of the most high-profile professions you can, and here you're going to try to make a name for yourself. The Woodfield family was well known in the area. They were respected, and they all resided in a town called Otter Rock. They appeared to be the perfectly normal American family.
While Woodfield was in high school, he would run track and played football. He was a pretty decent athlete, but he also began exhibiting some problematic behavior. For example, one time he stood in the Yakinaw Bay Bridge and exposed himself to a group of teenage girls. Woodfield was arrested for indecent exposure, and his parents sent him to a therapist, which, you know, kudos to them. I mean, that seems like an appropriate thing to do, right? The therapist was not overly concerned by what he referred to as Woodfield exploring his sexuality. I'm going to tell you, man, I'm not a therapist, but I think there's something a little weird about a middle school boy exposing himself to this degree.
Well, this was also the 1960s. These are flower children expressing themselves, and everybody's exploring and trying to figure out who they are and wanting to be known for individuality and self-expression. So this is a different time. Yes, right now, this is never okay. This is a horrible offense. Not that it was any better back then, but if you look at it through the paradigm of time, then I think you understand that in the 60s, this wasn't as big of a deal. Does that make sense?
It does. I guess I'm just too stuck in the right here, right now. But the thing that troubles me is his football coaches knew about this situation, and they even helped conceal the situation so that he would not get kicked off the team. That, I feel like, still very much happens.
That happens. That's such a prevalent problem in college athletics right now. They got to have these guys eligible. They got to have these guys ready to play. Can't play if you're in jail. So they cover a lot of stuff up, unfortunately.
So I mentioned he got charged with this. However, when he turned 18, his juvenile record would become expunged.
So let's talk about that. That's a pretty common thing, right? Like when any minor offender reaches the age of 18, the record becomes sealed or expunged to where it's like they've never done anything.
Yeah.
I totally get it. In some ways, like, you don't want something you did when you're 13 preventing you from getting a job or getting into college. But some things are important and I feel like should be at least available to authorities. Do you have thoughts on that? Because I know you see kids with records in your work.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you just said. On one hand, I feel like it is okay for it to go away because you were a kid back then, and let's give you a second chance. Let's not automatically hinder you from pursuing your dreams. And then if you get busted again, then it becomes a problem. However, like you mentioned with the sexual things, there is some concern that just because you turn 18 doesn't mean that part of your life is going to go away. And you could put a person in a pretty bad situation. Like, if a 17-year-old gets arrested for sexually abusing a child, it's expunged, and then that person becomes 21 and wants to work at a preschool, there's a freaking problem there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that there is some pros and cons for sure.
Yeah, that's a good point. After high school, Woodfield went on to community college to play football. He was playing at Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario, Oregon. He wasn't there long. He was there for one football season, but he also ended up getting in trouble during his time there. He was arrested for ransacking and vandalizing his ex-girlfriend's house. Now, there wasn't enough evidence to get him convicted. He was charged, but a jury found him not guilty of this aggressive behavior toward his ex-girlfriend. Now, his time playing football at that community college got him noticed. In 1970, he transferred to Portland State University in Portland, where he played wide receiver for the Portland State Vikings. His football coach would later recall, "When he was with me, he was the nicest, most gentlemanly kid I ever knew. He was quiet and polite, hardworking, and coachable."
Are we talking about Ted Bundy or Randy?
Yeah, this is Randy Woodfield. He's putting this persona out there that he's a relaxed, calm, nice guy. Other teammates, though, described him as an athlete, and they were always impressed by the way that he worked on the field, but also said he was a loner and didn't have a lot of friends. Now, unfortunately, his legal troubles followed him to Portland State as well. He would be arrested while there multiple times for indecent exposure, much like we talked about earlier, just exposing himself out in public, and he would be convicted for this while he was in college two different times.
So he didn't learn his lesson in middle school is what you're saying. So as a full-grown man in college, he's still being a weirdo.
Yeah. So maybe that's something that's the perfect example of something that he did before he was an adult and then repeated that behavior after, but there was no record of it because it was expunged.
So he dropped out of college just three semesters shy of graduating because he had achieved his dream of being drafted by the NFL. In 1974, the Green Bay Packers drafted Woodfield in the 17th round. Okay, number one, didn't know there were that many rounds. I don't think there are today. So he might not have been drafted if the draft were happening today, but he could have been like a free agent and been signed by a team, something like that.
Right. There are seven rounds currently in the NFL draft. It used to be, like you said, a lot longer. But even for him to go, like, be a community college player that ended up getting drafted, this is a really big deal. And by the Packers, at this time, I mean, the Packers were killing it.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that was any boy's dream. So he fulfilled it. He was, you know, he had a lot of success in life. And that's just another one of those things. I mean, kudos to him. But we're going to keep going. He was offered a one-year contract for $16,000. The deal came with a $2,000 signing bonus if he caught 25 passes in the fall and $3,000 if he caught 30. So for reference, the average NFL player salary in 1974 was $27,500. So he was being paid, what, around $10,000 less on just his contract?
Yeah, the probably average for a 17th round pick.
So, yeah. I mean, that's nothing to turn your nose at, and you're getting to play on a prestigious NFL team. The contract also said that he had to keep himself in peak condition, avoiding consorting with gamblers and wear a coat and a necktie in public. I don't think they have those kind of stipulations today, but I guess maybe in certain situations, press conferences or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think they do as much with the dress policies, but they do have their performance metrics. Like, if you don't meet a certain weight or you can't run something this fast, then you're not meeting your end of the contract. So you're going to lose some money or lose some playing time or even get cut, depending on where you are in the depth chart.
So he signed almost immediately, and he had to quit his job at the Burger Chef.
Tough decision there, Burger Chef or Packers.
You know, I know you don't want to talk about Tennessee football, but we do have a player who wasn't playing football. He was actually working at a dollar store, and Tennessee offered him, and he came up the ranks and signed with the football team, and he's a starter now. So, I don't know. Everybody's got to do their part. He was working at Burger Chef. So, leading up to the season, Woodfield spent months staying in shape and working out on his pass catching. His biggest problem, however, was that he hated and feared being hit on the field. You can't be a good wide receiver if you're always looking over your shoulder.
Gotta have bravery. Drop passes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You gotta be able to go over the middle. You're gonna get hit.
One of those things that my quarterback did that my wide receivers hated is if you're playing in the slot, so close to the line, and you do a little route over the middle, there's always gonna be a linebacker there, or your safety's gonna pop up and knock you. So this guy would not like that very much. The Packers sent him a first-class plane ticket and arranged for a limo to pick him up from the airport. That's a pretty big deal. Woodfield declined. He opted to drive himself to Wisconsin. In July, he was among the rookies playing against the Bears in a scrimmage at Lambeau Field. But moving across the country didn't help Woodfield leave behind his other propensities. After a lackluster athletic performance and a dozen other flashing incidents, the Packers formally cut Woodfield from the NFL before the season even began. Again, I said a dozen other incidents. So this guy is just escalating his numbers right now. And, you know, he's well into adulthood. This guy has a major problem.
I mean, his contract did say he had to wear a shirt and tie. It didn't say anything about wearing pants.
It's too low, man.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about Woodfield's life after football and how he ended up becoming the I-5 killer.
Hey guys, Jamie and John here, and we want to tell you how excited we are to be able to offer new merchandise for our podcasts.
Yeah, we have partnered with a company called TeePublic. We have listed the links to our store below in our show notes. We've also put those on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But Jamie, there's a ton of stuff you can find over there.
T-shirts, phone cases, mugs, travel mugs, hoodies, and even masks, John.
There is a ton of new products over there. It's way better than the store we used to have. You can customize your order. Like if you want a shirt that's yellow or green or blue, whatever, you can make that happen. So go over there and check that out today, and you will not be disappointed.
When Woodfield was cut by the Packers, he wasn't really ready to leave Wisconsin and go home and face those that he left behind, as he told them he was going to be playing in the NFL. So he ended up moving an hour and a half away from Green Bay to Oshkosh, Wisconsin. He was able to get on a semi-pro football team there called the Manitowoc Chiefs. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because that is the setting for the Stephen Avery Teresa Halbach case for making a murderer. So he's living in this same town, playing for this semi-pro football team. He assumed that playing nearby might get the attention of the Packers again if he performs well and he could get a call back to that team. After that season, though, he was yet again cut by the Chiefs. They didn't give a reason for cutting him, but there were rumors that the team had off-field concerns. And again, all these things that he's doing is not representing the organization well, and he's staying in trouble.
Have you ever heard the famous Alabama football head coach Nick Saban talk about the off-field incidents when he's looking at players?
Yeah,
yeah, he calls it the "yeah, but." Like, you never want to be the "yeah, but" guy. Like, you could have just an incredible season. You could be scoring all kinds of touchdowns. But when the people that are in charge of these huge organizations are looking at you, and you have to say, "yeah, but," he's been flashing people on the side, you're the "yeah, but" guy.
Years later, one Wisconsin law enforcement officer recalled that he just couldn't keep his thing in his pants. And that's a direct quote from police. With his dreams of being a pro football player officially over, he traveled back to the Pacific Northwest, and his criminal career really took off.
In late 1974, Woodfield was back in Oregon, and by early 1975, several Portland women were being attacked by a knife-wielding man, forcing them to perform oral sex and stealing their handbags. To respond to this growing problem, law enforcement had female undercover officers act as decoys. What a dangerous job. You know
that is. How would you like to be the person? It's like, all right, you're going to be the bait. Go out here in front of this dangerous individual. We promise we'll come rescue you. But what if they don't?
Yeah, man. Kudos to these ladies who would stand in harm's way just to try to catch this guy. On March 3rd, 1975, Woodfield was arrested after he was caught with marked money from one of their undercover officers. When he was interrogated, he confessed and blaming poor sexual impulse control. Yeah. I mean,
duh.
Yeah. So he claimed that his use of steroids made it impossible to control himself. Well, I don't buy that either. In April 1975, Woodfield pled guilty to reduced charges of second-degree robbery. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, but Jamie, he was actually released on parole after just serving 4 years.
And this isn't his first offense. He's already been caught twice while he was in Portland State. He's been arrested a dozen times, or at least confronted a dozen times while he was in Green Bay. This isn't new. It's just escalating. So for escalating crimes, we're reducing his sentence, which seems like the opposite of what we should be doing. So now it's 1979, and an unreformed, unremorseful sex offender is back on the streets. He was out of jail just in time to attend his 10-year high school reunion. So he ended up attending his reunion. You would think that somebody who goes off and says they're going to play for the NFL, comes back and spends 4 years in prison, isn't going to be excited to show his face. That's exactly what he does, and he reconnects with a former classmate named Sherry Ayers. On October 11th of 1980, Sherry's fiance found her raped and murdered in her apartment in downtown Portland. She had been left there for 2 days. She had been brutally bludgeoned and stabbed in the neck. It turns out that while Woodfield was in prison, he and Sherry had actually already connected. They were sending letters back and forth, and the conversations were getting more and more intensely sexual. Sherry's family immediately told police to look at Woodfield for this murder. He would be questioned, but refused to take a polygraph test. His answer to detectives were described as evasive and deceptive, but his blood type didn't match the semen that was found at the victim's body. Again, this is old science. We're not talking DNA. We don't know a lot about the types of indicators we can get from blood and semen at this time. So no charges were filed. And as it turns out, he was really just getting started. In the next 5 months, he would go on a crime spree that terrorized the area around Interstate 5.
On November 27th, which would be Thanksgiving Day in 1980, Woodfield went to Darcy Fix's house. So he knew the 22-year-old during college because she was the ex-girlfriend of one of his former friends. So Douglas Altig was at Darcy's house when Woodford arrived. He tied up Douglas and Darcy and shot both of them execution style. When investigators looked at the scene, it appeared that Darcy's .32 caliber revolver was missing. Because he knew Darcy, Woodfield was questioned, but there was no concrete evidence to prove that he was the one who did this crime.
So he's showing up just kind of on the peripheral of all these crimes with his horrific record, but continues to get away with these things. So we talked about him being a killer, and obviously he shot people execution style. He's bludgeoned and stabbed people. But he was first known as the I-5 Bandit because of his robberies. On December 9th of 1980, he put on a fake beard and put tape on his nose and held up a Vancouver, Washington gas station at gunpoint. Four nights later, in the same getup, he robbed an ice cream parlor in Eugene, Oregon. Now, I'm not a career criminal. I don't rob a lot of places. If I was gonna try to get some cash, I don't think an ice cream parlor would be on my list of places to get. The night after that, though, he would end up robbing a drive-in restaurant in Albany, Oregon. And then we see more escalation. On December 21st, he accosted a waitress in Seattle. He trapped her in a bathroom and held her at gunpoint, forcing her to give him sexual favors.
On January 18th, 1981, Sherry Hole had been wrapping up her shift cleaning the Trans American office building in Kaiser, Oregon. As she was leaving, she was grabbed by a man who'd snuck into the building. And again, he held a gun on her and walked her down the hall where they encountered Beth Wilmot. The assailant took both women in the back room and sexually assaulted both of them. Then he shot each of them in the back of the head. Somehow on this earth, Beth miraculously survived the situation. She pretended to be dead by laying motionless on the floor. She had bullets in her back of her head, but as soon as her attacker was gone, she was able to get up and call police. How in the world is that possible?
Yeah, I don't know how people survive these kinds of things. Beth was obviously really tough and really brave and was able to call police to report what happened to get them on the scene. On February 3rd of 1981, Donna Eckerd and her 14-year-old daughter were found dead in a bed in their home in Mountain Gate, California. They had each been shot several times in the head. Forensics showed that the girl had been sexually assaulted. And that very same day in nearby Redding, California, there was a female store clerk that was kidnapped and sexually assaulted in a holdup. The next day, an identical crime happened in Eureka, California. And that night, the same man in the same disguise robbed a motel in Ashland, Oregon. So this is just an absolute crime frenzy over 3 or 4 days here. And then 5 days later, a man matching this description held up a fabric store. So here we see him robbing a motel, a fabric store, and an ice cream parlor. It's almost like he's desperate for the thrill of robbing places instead of just trying to steal money. He's not hitting banks here.
Yeah, I think he's driven by this and mostly the sexual assault pieces of it.
Well, that certainly was part of the motivation here as he molested the clerk before he left the scene of that fabric store. On February 12th, there were more reported robberies by people who suspected the I-5 bandit in Vancouver, Olympia, and Bellevue, Washington. The Olympia and Bellevue incidents included 3 sexual assaults. On February 14th, Woodfield planned a Valentine's Day party at the Portland Marriott Hotel. He invited friends and acquaintances from college, but nobody showed up to the party. Out of anger, he decided that he was going to go find somebody that he knew and ended up at the door of 18-year-old Julie Reitz. He had met Julie once when he was working as a bouncer in Portland, and Julie tried to get in with a fake ID. He let her in with a fake ID and noted her name and address. So when he got to her house at 2 a.m. on February 15th, she was shocked. Just a couple hours later, he raped and then shot Julie in the head. When police were investigating Julie's home, they saw that he had gotten a glass of wine and drank it along with Julie before he sexually assaulted her. and he had also started making a pot of coffee. A package of instant coffee was on the kitchen counter, and there was water in a kettle that had completely boiled away as he had left it boiling.
At this point, the police were able to be focused on Woolfield. Marion County detectives put together a call log showing that he had placed calls with a calling card and on payphones near the areas where the murders took place. On March 5th, 1981, Woodfield was brought into the Salem Police Department for interrogation. One of his previous victims, Lisa Garcia, identified him in a photo lineup. His apartment was able to be searched, and that's when they found a spent .32 shell casing inside of a racquetball bag. They also found a roll of tape that matched the tape found on the victims. On March 7th, he was taken into custody after more robbery victims positively ID'd him. By March 16th, there were more indictments. These were for murder, rape, sodomy, attempted kidnapping, armed robbery, and illegal possession of firearms came from jurisdictions in Washington and in Oregon.
I could picture this arraignment where the judge asks, what are the charges? And the attorney just says, all of them, all of the charges.
Like when I went for an allergy test one time, I came in for the results and my doctor was like, it'll be easier for me to tell you the things you're not allergic to. Like, yeah, we're not going to charge you with robbing a school bus, but everything else.
Everything else.
Yeah. In late summer of 1981, Woodfield was tried in Salem for the murder of Sherry Hull, the woman in the Trans-American building, and the attempted murder of Beth Wilmot. Beth testified against him in that trial, and that played a big part in the prosecutor's case. I mean, the fact that she made it out of this and was able to testify is just really a miracle to me. So the Marion County District Attorney prosecuting the case, his name was Chris Van Dyke. Does that name sound familiar to you at all?
Absolutely. Famous actors named Dick Van Dyke and Jerry Van Dyke. Is he related to them?
Yeah. Well, he is the son of the actor Dick Van Dyke.
So wow.
A little fun fact there. On June 26, 1981, after just 3.5 hours of deliberation, Randall Woodfield was convicted on all counts and sentenced to life in prison plus 90 years.
In October of that same year, Woodfield had a second trial in Benton County, Oregon. In this trial, he faced sodomy and weapons charges from one of the attacks in a restaurant bathroom. The defense team did all they could to move the trial to another county, claiming that all the media attention would keep Woodfield from getting a fair trial. The judge denied that request and a request to hypnotize a prosecution's witness to determine if they'd been influenced by the media. In research, we find that all kinds of people were tested with hypnosis, both as witnesses to try to remember things they didn't remember or try to get clarity on things they were lying about. I've never seen that in an attempt to show that somebody was influenced by the media. So I found that interesting.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. We've talked about investigators talking with mediums and, you know, fortune tellers, but this is a new one for me.
Woodfield would be convicted by this jury as well and got yet another 35 years added to his sentence.
Even though they had reason to link him to several other crimes, the state of Oregon decided not to pursue more charges. I mean, they were really trying to save money because these trials cost a lot of money and they wanted to spare the families from the entire ordeal. Now, we'll talk in a minute about whether we agree or disagree with that, but they were satisfied with Woodfield's existing life sentences. I mean, they knew that no matter what they convicted him of, he's not going to get out of prison. But that didn't mean they stopped investigating. By 1990, they discovered more victims, and Woodfield has been suspected in as many as 44 murders and over 60 unsolved rapes. By 2012, DNA had positively linked Woodfield to 5 more murders, including Darcy Fix, her fiancé Douglas Altig, Donna Eckerd, and her teenage daughter.
Woodfield never confessed to any of these crimes. He's currently still serving his sentences at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. During his time in prison, he has been married 3 times and divorced 2. In October of 1983, he was injured by a fellow inmate during a prison disturbance. A few years later, in April of 1987, he filed a $12 million libel suit against author Anne Rule. Rule had written a book about Woodfield called The I-5 Killer, but you may better know her as her work on The Stranger Beside Me, where she wrote about working side by side with Ted Bundy. So she's a writer that's been all too close to too many serial killers. The federal court in Oregon ultimately dismissed his lawsuit, saying that the statute of limitations had expired on his ability to sue her for defamation. Today, Woodfield's around 70 years old, and prison guards claim that he only loves to talk about football. He can recall every moment of his glory days, from playing in college to his limited time in Green Bay, but he won't talk about much of anything else. So, John, I guess now's the question. Do we agree with the state's decision not to prosecute on these other charges? Is this justice?
I totally understand wanting to save money and being satisfied with his, you know, he's never going to get out of jail. But at the same time, it does not feel like justice for those victims. I wish that there was a way, I guess that breaks our constitution, right? Like, I wish you could definitively say somebody did this without going through a complete jury trial.
Right. And yeah, I don't know what kind of statute you could add to say he's already serving life. The standard of guilt is going to be lowered to try to get justice for some of these families without putting the state in even more debt. And this, I don't know, they claim that this is not going to put the families through the emotional toll of reliving these crimes. But at the same time, I feel like if you ask the families, some of them are going to say, yeah, I don't want to relive that. But others are going to say, no, I want him to face up for murdering my loved one, to face a jury for that. And I want to look him in his eyes when he's sentenced.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of all this, is there an amount of money that you wouldn't pay to see this guy get consequences that he deserved? I mean, I think that they should do it. And I know it's a lot of money, but still, these families are people just like us, and they deserve justice.
And there are other victims that got justice. Why is my loved one the one that doesn't get to have their day in court, have their name read aloud from the witness stand? So I completely feel like there's got to be a way to get over this budgetary issue. I don't know what that is. I don't have the answers, but I think it's pretty clear that we've identified a problem that we see in many cases.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I think we're on the same page on this one.
Awesome. I didn't expect to get this fired up today, but here we are.
Yeah. Guys, we appreciate you listening to True Crime Cast. This was a pretty interesting case. It's interesting to see how this guy started off with flashing somebody as a middle schooler to killing almost 50 people. Pretty mind-blowing how somebody can escalate that much.
Right, and especially when we talk about his childhood, we didn't see the kind of trauma that we normally see here. So as looking back to his past, I think it would be more difficult to predict what he was going to turn into than a lot of our other perpetrators.
All right, we're going to call this one done. Again, thank you for all those folks who signed up on Patreon and continue to look into that. It's a lot of great content. Look, the holidays are coming up. You're going to have a lot of awkward time around your family that you don't want to be sitting there talking to them. Why not sign up for Patreon? Binge listen to hours and hours of content. Avoid your family.
Yeah, just hit us up and put us on that Bluetooth speaker. And if they don't want to listen, maybe they'll just go ahead and go home.
Yeah. Guys, we appreciate you. Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.